From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor with National Journal, and David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. A three-day ceasefire and fighting in Gaza between Israel and Hamas unraveled hours after the agreement was reached. The United States and the European Union imposed new and tougher sanctions against Russia for its interference in Ukraine and support for pro-Russia rebels. And in Washington, Republicans in the House of Representatives approved a lawsuit against President Obama as legislation to deal with the surge of young illegal immigrants across America's southern border failed in both houses of Congress. Well, David, certainly didn't take long for the ceasefire to fall apart, hours after it was agreed to. And the Israelis announced that one of their soldiers, I think a lieutenant, had been actually captured by Hamas, which is another complicating factor. But where do we stand? We're talking on Friday. Where do things stand, do you think?
Well, all week there has been, you know, talk of can we get to the next humanitarian ceasefire? There needs to be a pause in the fighting. But I think what's been becoming clear in terms of kind of taking a step back from the kind of the minute-by-minute confusion is that a couple of big things really have changed. We can see a couple of things really have changed. One is the very dramatic change of government in Egypt. The fact that the government of the Muslim Brotherhood, which had allowed the tunnels to run freely through, the fact that you've now got the military-backed government of former Field Marshal al-Sisi, now President al-Sisi, taking a very tough line on Hamas in the peace talks, which they're sort of helping to broker, essentially much closer to some of the Israeli demands for the ceasefire than they are to the Hamas demands, a sort of asymmetry there. And a real sense that some of those kind of more authoritarian Arab regimes, including some of the Gulf monarchies, were privately not that unhappy to see Hamas getting pounded by Israel. It suited their own strategic interests. And so a real sense of sort of that was something new and something. It was not clear how that was going to end up. Constant efforts to have at least these brief humanitarian ceasefires, and the latest one ending, you know, unbelievably quickly, and then ending not only with that, but then with a total mess as to had the second lieutenant been captured, had that happened before the ceasefire, during the ceasefire. You know, a real sense of a very, very dangerous moment, but with some new dynamics that we haven't seen before.
Wasn't also the Palestinian Authority, which is in the West Bank, against Hamas as well? I mean, they're probably happy to see Hamas getting pounded. After all, the Palestinian Authority had endorsed this Egyptian ceasefire agreement that turned out Hamas rejected, along with Saudi Arabia and some of the countries that you described. The United States actually did not endorse that ceasefire that was proposed by the Egyptians.
It's clear that the kind of the traditional gap between the most extreme Palestinian representatives, places like Hamas that don't even recognize Israel's right to exist, and the, you know, mildly more moderate and certainly, you know, more willing to talk to Israel Palestinian Authority, that gap does still exist. It's still clinging to existence. There is no love lost between the government of Mahmoud Abbas in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Gaza, controlled by Hamas. But the other big thing that's changed the last couple of weeks, the last few weeks, is a real sense of kind of despair on the Palestinian side, particularly when you saw Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel saying that, partly to placate his own hardliners, that the military occupation of the West Bank would have to continue for a very long time, by which he meant decades. And that, so there's a real sense of if there's any momentum towards a two-state solution, that's in real jeopardy. So we're into very, very new and uncharted waters now.
Tom, let me ask you about the American role. There was a wave of criticism of Secretary of State John Kerry when he reached an agreement with Hamas on their idea for a ceasefire. Then, after talking to them in Paris, or at least through someone else, since the U.S. technically does not deal with Hamas. And it was something that outraged the Israelis and a lot of others. What about the U.S. role and Kerry's role, and why didn't they endorse the Egyptian ceasefire idea?
I just don't understand. I don't understand why why they didn't. I think part of it is President Obama is still upset with the Egyptians, a de facto military government with General al-Sisi, now the president. I think it's complicated, but it's inexplicable. You can't get anything done in the Middle East without the help of Egypt, even if it's below the radar sort of help. I don't understand that. I think the other dynamic that is interesting is the what appears to be personal as well as ideological differences between Israel and the United States. I mean,
you mean between Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama?
Well, that's not new. These two leaders have not been close.
It seems like it's become a little sharper.
Well, when you have unnamed Israeli sources close to the prime minister referring to the latest American overture as a strategic terrorist attack, and then they quickly disavow it. There's really the friction has really gotten worse. Now, of course, I don't think this changes the strategic relationship between Israel and the United States, and I think Netanyahu knows that, and so he and his friends can more or less pop off with impunity. I mean, we've seen this before. I remember when former Secretary of State Jim Baker got so frustrated with the Israelis that at a Senate committee, he gave out the White House switchboard number and said to the Israelis, when you're ready to be serious about peace, call. And that didn't go over so well. But I think you don't expect this kind of friction in a Democratic administration. Mm-hmm. And it is real and it is deep.
Mm-hmm. David, I'll have to say I don't see any workable agreement that could possibly happen between Israel and Hamas. I mean, as you pointed out, Hamas is a founding principle, practically, is the destruction of Israel. And we know now, remember, there was this issue, Israel complained about all the concrete that was being imported into Gaza by Hamas, and it was said, well, they were just going to use it to build schools and hospitals, and now we know they used a good bit of it, at least, to build these tunnels into Israel.
But it seems to me there's a short and a long-term problem here, which is in the short term, I don't think anyone reasonable denies that Israel has the right to defend itself against rockets landing on its territory. Any country would. Mm-hmm. Israel certainly has to take these tunnels being dug into its territory extremely seriously. So nobody denies that. But there's a long-term problem, mm-hmm. which is that if you are Israel, a democracy in this neighborhood, planning not to be in a state of war forever, how does this end? I mean, can Israel...
Well, that's sort of my question.
Can Israel kill its way to a solution? Can mm-hmm. Israel bomb its way to a solution? Mm-hmm. Can Israel build enough walls to make normal life kind of in a sort of fortress context? I have to say, you know, my own magazine, The Economist, you know, we're very supportive of Israel's right to defend herself, but we don't believe that Israel has a clear sense of how to get out of this in the long term. Mm-hmm. And leaving aside, you know, there is no negotiating with Hamas right now. But some of the breaches between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority over the last few months, mm-hmm. some of the frustration you hear from Americans who are deeply involved in those talks, you know, Israel has borne its share of the blame here. You know, its position on settlement activity, its position on not being willing to ever give a date where the West Bank might be allowed to, you know, not have Israeli soldiers in the West Bank, you know, the position on the Israeli side has hardened tremendously. And to Tom's point about the degree of a sort of public vituperation between the two sides, one of the new very dangerous dynamics that senior officials here in Washington point out is until very recently, Israeli prime ministers who fell out with America publicly would suffer a backlash eventually in Israeli public opinion. Israeli public opinion would get very anxious about too public a breach with an American president.
Mm-hmm.
That's changing. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's mm-hmm. the Israeli left, mm-hmm. as well as the Israeli right, piling mm-hmm. in on the mm-hmm. Americans. There doesn't seem to be a downside. Benjamin Netanyahu's approval ratings are up in the 80%. Mm-hmm. So that's a very, very strange kind of unpredictable dynamic.
Yeah, that is new, because in the past, the Israeli prime minister has had one overriding task, and that was getting along well with the American administration, especially the American president.
And at least maintaining the sort of fiction yeah. that this was mm-hmm. a bipartisan approach, that Israel
right.
didn't take a sort of view as to whether mm-hmm. it preferred Democrats or Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's pretty clear. Netanyahu has thrown his mm-hmm. lot in. He prefers Republicans. Mm-hmm. He doesn't trust Democrats. It's become, you know, the partisanship of Washington yeah. runs all the way to Jerusalem now.
That was clear when I happened to go on the trip to Israel that Mitt Romney took in 2012 during his presidential campaign. And believe me, the Israeli government rolled out the red carpet, in one case, literally rolled out a red carpet for Mitt Romney. And while there was no official endorsement, obviously, of Mitt Romney, the strong preference for him over Obama's reelection was awfully clear. Tom, what about the future here? It's hard to see an agreement between Hamas and Israel. And on the other hand, I take David's suggestion. I agree with it. Israel cannot exist in a state of active war year after year after year.
I remember I've been thinking a lot lately about President Nixon, because we're coming up soon on the 40th anniversary mm-hmm. of his resignation. And I can remember at one point in his first term, which was 1968, his first term, mm-hmm. yes, he gave an interview which basically said Israel will win the next several wars, mm-hmm. but ultimately they're destined to lose because they have, I can't remember the figures Nixon mm-hmm. said. He said there are 8 million Israelis and they're surrounded by 270 million mm-hmm. Arabs. And one way or the other, Israel has got to find a way to, mm-hmm. to come up with a diplomatic solution, because they will never be able to fight wars to gain the peace, because mm-hmm. they'll be fighting them forever, and at some mm-hmm. point they won't be able to mm-hmm. to make it happen. We'll see. It really is a conundrum. As mm-hmm. David has says, you cannot make peace with a group that has said that you have no right to exist. Mm-hmm. It's committed itself to the annihilation of Israel, mm-hmm. but something's got to give here, and I think Netanyahu has more leeway to wage war now, no matter what President mm-hmm. Obama thinks about that, right. than an Israeli mm-hmm. prime minister may have had mm-hmm. since the 1967 war.
Yeah, that's what David was suggesting. Well, let me try one other thing here about where things might head from here. Is it feasible for the more moderate states, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, several of the Gulf states, not Qatar, and the Palestinian Authority, all to agree on something with Israel and isolate Hamas, which is already pretty isolated, and move in that direction?
Well, I think if you
I'm purposely vague here.
If you talk to American diplomats or European diplomats, you know, that's more or less their kind of template. Find Palestinians and Palestinian allies that you can deal with, mm-hmm. Strengthen them, try and find areas of common ground, and isolate Hamas. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an obvious thing to do when you have one, you know, utterly intransigent partner. The problem is that over the last few months, you had these unbelievably intensive efforts by Secretary of State John Kerry to try and find some common ground between Israel and that more moderate Palestinian bloc in the Palestinian mm-hmm. Authority. And it's gone backwards. It's mm-hmm. been really, really sort of utterly disillusioning. You can meet Americans who have very good information about these talks who say, you know, there is just so little common ground. You know, that take the status of Jerusalem, you know. Mm-hmm. The position from Benjamin Netanyahu at the moment is that he will tolerate the Palestinians having an aspiration mm-hmm. to it being their capital in part. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no sort of possible way for a Palestinian Authority leader to accept that kind of position. And the Palestinians have also gone off into their own hardline mm-hmm. position. And the final point is mm-hmm. the gap's now so big, the common ground is now vanishing so fast, that there are some practical issues here. At the moment, Israel has no desire to fully reoccupy the West Bank. So Israeli security officials have day-to-day reasonably good practical contacts with Palestinian Authority security officials. Mm-hmm. Between them, they organize, you know, how they're going to coexist in this space that Israel does not want to reoccupy. It's getting increasingly hard for those contacts to take place. Mm-hmm. You know, if this keeps breaking down, you know, if the Palestinian Authority is coming under huge pressure mm-hmm. from its own public opinion, you know, all of these sort of practical sort of sticking plaster measures that we've seen over the last few months, they're going to fall apart.
It would be hard for I can understand the Palestinians, it would be hard for them to accept the idea of having their capital in, say, half of Jerusalem, since they'd been offered twice by separate prime ministers of Israel exactly that, getting half of Jerusalem as part of an overall agreement.
Right. I mean, we've been talking at these microphones for years, Fred, about mm-hmm. how intractable this situation is mm-hmm. and that it's just crazy to bet on peace in this mm-hmm. region of the world. But it seems the environment at the moment seems bleaker than I can ever remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does. I'm thinking perhaps that the Netanyahu hardline might be a product of the war that's going on with Hamas, and that he could back away from that if Hamas were defeated.
But define defeat. I mean, you cannot, you know, every insurgency, and you can't compare like with like, but, you know, successive governments from my country, Britain, you know, trying to defeat the IRA in Northern Ireland militarily. At the end of the day, you cannot kill your way to ending a sort of nationalist separatist uprising. You have to find a political solution. There are only political solutions when two groups of people have overlapping claims to the same piece of land. Such conflicts can only end politically. They cannot end militarily.
Well, you could at least stop the rockets from being fired on
Israel. And that's totally legitimate. Yeah. That's why I say there's a short-term, long-term distinction. In the short term, Israel has every right to defend itself. No country would want these rockets landing in. But Israel is, you know, our cover this week says Israel is winning the battle but losing the war. And finally, and European public opinion, and it's very often characterized here in Washington as it's all just kind of, you know, the anti-Semites burning Israeli flags outside synagogues in places like Paris. That exists, and it's very ugly, and it needs to be, you know, watched very carefully and controlled. But moderate, reasonable European public opinion is deeply, deeply upset by the sheer discrepancy in the numbers of deaths on the two sides, a sense that the Israeli government is not living up to its own sort of high standards in terms of targeting, not trying to kill civilians, not trying to kill children. You know, moderate European, reasonable European opinion is very rapidly sort of questioning the idea that Israel is another friendly Western democracy. I happen to, you know, I'm not that far. I think Israel still remains clearly our ally, a friend, a democracy in that region. But its reputation is really in jeopardy now, not in America, but in Europe.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break here and turn to a couple more issues. First reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes, of the Weekly Standard. And joining me today are David Rennie of The Economist, who you just heard, and Tom DeFrank of National Journal. And this is a reminder, you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Tom, the tougher sanctions against Russia and President Vladimir Putin, they really are tougher. The question is, are they tough enough to make a difference and change Putin's behavior?
I think it's a little too early to know that. At the moment, his behavior has not changed. You still have increasing numbers of Russian troops massing along the border with Ukraine. There's no evidence that Putin's government has stopped arming and training the pro-Moscow Ukrainian separatists. But I suppose we'll have to see just how much economic pain kicks in from these sanctions. I agree with you. They are tougher. The Europeans finally have gotten a little bit of backbone and have done some things that many interests in those European countries were reluctant to do until the Malaysia Airlines flight was shot down. So I think this is a step forward in terms of raising the ante for President Putin. It's a little too early to see the real economic effect because President Obama and the EU ministers have said they believe that these sanctions will damage a Russian economy that is already in bad shape except for oil and gas. So we will see, but it's still a little early.
David, this is a problem that is, unlike the Middle East, not intractable, the dealings between Europe and the United States and Russia. But obviously, Putin's behavior will have to change. What about it?
Well, it's not intractable. You know, Russia could just stop doing horrible things, and that would make things a lot better. Vladimir Putin, as a exceedingly chilly, extremely pragmatic, ruthless operator, he could decide that his balance of interests has changed and these sanctions make a difference. So that, you know, there you could be an optimist. I think where there are real grounds for concern is that it has been so successful for Vladimir Putin and his sort of propaganda, sort of semi-intelligent, semi-sort of private sector propaganda machine, he has whipped the Russian population into such a frenzy of nationalism and sort of hatred of Ukraine. You know, Russian state television reporting the crucifixion of a three-year-old child in a public square in Ukraine. Complete fiction. Complete, you know, just a lie, just made up, but believed by Russians. You know, Russian public opinion overwhelmingly convinced that the Malaysian Airlines flight was not the fault of Russian-backed separatists. You know, they have a thousand contradictory conspiracy theories as to who did it, the Americans, the Jews, the Germans, you know, God knows, but not the, the Western version, because the West always lies. And like all of the, you know, like any autocrat who defends his public position at home by whipping his people into a frenzy of kind of xenophobic nationalism, you know, you're riding a tiger. And riding a tiger can be dangerous at times if you want to get off. It's much harder to get off a tiger than get on, than ride its back.
It doesn't look like Putin wants to get off.
Well, does he or doesn't he? He's surrounded by oligarchs whose interests are suffering, you know, in the economic terms. They are too frightened of Putin to say anything except private grumbling to reporters that they're very unhappy.
I'm frightened of Putin.
But does he fully control... I mean, he controls, you know, what happens with the military, but does he control the politics of this? Is, you know, is he able to back down if he needs to? If he, if the pragmatic, ruthless thing to do would be to now cut the separatists loose and say they made a mistake, because he didn't tell them to shoot that airliner down. You know, they made a terrible mistake, which didn't help him. Rationally, ruthlessly, well, he doesn't want to kill Malaysians. I mean, that's that's not his game plan.
Isn't it a little late to say that?
But he could have, you know, absent some of that kind of ferocious propaganda, he might have been able to take a cold, chilly decision to cut the separatists loose and to, and to isolate them, you know, just cut his losses. Except he's got Crimea, that's a great prize for him. He doesn't need to keep fighting this losing battle in Donetsk for some of these eastern Ukrainian areas. Has he left himself, you know, that room for maneuver? That's, I think, a legitimate concern.
Tom, that's a great question.
I agree.
What about
it? I agree with you, Fred. I don't think Putin wants to give up. I don't think he wants to cut his losses, and his losses are beginning to escalate.
What about the room to maneuver that David was suggesting? Does he have a room to maneuver now? I mean, if he...
And just for clarity, it's not that he'd want to give up because he suddenly turns nice. It's he'd want to give up eastern Ukraine because he's losing there.
Yeah, sure.
So you might as well cut your losses and avoid a public defeat.
Right, I think that's right. I mean, I think he could, but the problem is I don't think he sees the world like the rest of the world sees these sorts of things. I think he is committed to restoring a greater Russia, and I think it's going to be difficult for him to turn back. He called the shooting of the shooting down of the plane a tragedy. He could have gone further, and he doesn't have to say anything, but he could pull back. He could stop sending the rebels even more sophisticated ground-to-air missiles, and he shows no signs of doing that. It's all about power, and it's all about face, and I don't think he wants to do anything that suggests the evil West and the evil United States has somehow bested him. I mean, I just don't think he's got the DNA or the ego to allow that to happen.
You know, one more question, David, and that is, has Putin so, you know, poisoned the well with European and American leaders that even if he does back down, I mean, he's never going to have the kind of personal relationship that he had when Russia was a member of the G8?
That's a there has been a gigantic shift. So I used to cover European politics out of Brussels for 5 years. You know, you go back to the times of Gerhard Schröder, the German chancellor before the current German chancellor. You know, he thought of Putin, and there was a French president, Jacques Chirac. They talked of Putin as, you know, we welcome his balancing American hegemony. You know, it's good to have a multipolar world. You know, Russia has a lot of good things to say about the world order. You know, Vladimir Putin gave an address to the German parliament in Berlin, got standing ovations. You know, there was a real sense that it was a good thing to have a sort of counterbalance to America. That's really changing. I think there's been an extraordinary shift just the last kind of 2 or 3 weeks where big European businessmen, some big European politicians, concluding that actually it is very hard to do business with Vladimir Putin, that he has been caught lying, particularly his relationship with Angela Merkel. You know, she was always pretty wary of him. She's no fool. She used to, she grew up in Eastern Germany. She understands people like Putin. But, you know, she had big German businesses telling her to make sure that the relationship with Russia was as smooth as possible. There's a real sense, I mean, she hasn't spoken to him for days and days and days. There's a real sense that she is kind of through with him right now in terms of he lied to her so sort of blatantly that the idea of him as a kind of credible negotiating partner has changed in Europe.
Well, it seems to me that's a huge loss for Putin in particular. Tom, I'm going to let you handle the summer, all of this. Both the Senate and the House had bills to the president asked for money so he could deal with this huge influx of particularly young people crossing the border from Mexico, then although most of them are from Central American countries like Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala. that was blocked in the Senate, and Republicans had a separate bill in the House that was going to give less money, but the Republicans themselves couldn't agree on it. What's going to happen here? Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, declared that the border was secure, but obviously it's not, at least in a part of Texas.
It's definitely not secure, Fred. You know, it's just crazy. I mean, there's a well-known columnist for Time magazine named Joe Klein who wrote the other day that America has now become a country brain-fried by partisan frenzy. And I think that's an understatement. You have this situation where everybody, both parties, and even the Republicans have said we have this humanitarian crisis, mm-hmm. we have a security crisis mm-hmm. on the border, this has to be fixed. And yet Congress has now gone home for 5 weeks. They won't come back until after Labor Day.
Well, the Senate anyway.
Nothing's going to get done to solve a humanitarian crisis. I think there were not enough votes in the in either House to pass even a middle ground approach. And what the real change was that what I would call the hardline right of the Republican Party in the House, once again, not the first time this mm-hmm. year, defied its leadership and would not vote for a more modest mm-hmm. immigration bill to deal with a humanitarian right. crisis. The Republican leadership wanted to spend $690 million, mm-hmm. not the $3.7 billion
right.
that Obama wanted, but they couldn't bring it to the floor because they knew it would lose mm-hmm. on the votes of their own side. So we just have this incredible mess, and I don't know how we get out of it, not in the short term, that's for sure. I mean, there is just so much animosity on both sides, so much antipathy between the Republicans. I mean, mm-hmm. Some Republicans are still muttering about impeaching the president. The House mm-hmm. of Representatives yeah. is going to sue mm-hmm. the president, claiming that he is selectively enforcing the Affordable Care Act, the Health Care Act, and that is unconstitutional. And it's a mess, and nobody's talking to one another really either. That's the problem.
Well, David, we have a very little time left, but I know you can be extremely terse.
I don't think we should talk ourselves into a frenzy. The border is not insecure. You know, if it was insecure, there'd be people popping up all over America mm-hmm. who sneaked past border guards. That's not what's happening. What's happening is children are going and handing themselves into the nearest border mm-hmm. guard. So the border is secure, mm-hmm. but we're talking ourselves into a border panic. There's a refugee crisis, mm-hmm. which is very hard to fix politically, mm-hmm. but the border is not insecure, but we're talking ourselves into a panic.
Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.